the trouble. So what I want to talk about is role of feedback in setting galaxy size and angular momenta. And for this crowd, I don't need to argue too much about the importance of stellar feedback. And I'll be talking about mostly stellar feedback, not AGN feedback. Roman told us that that's what the workshop is all about. AGN is a dirty word here. So I don't need to explain you the overall importance of feedback, but I'll focus on the role of a very significant role of feedback in setting angular momentum of galaxies, which for those who were here 2 weeks ago, Michael has argued that that's a basic physical parameter that is primary and should replace qualitative morphology classification. And the size of galaxy, I would argue, the second most important galaxy parameter, because in, the first one is stellar mass, and together stellar mass and size determine characteristic surface density of galaxies, which affect many different things. So, so that's what I'll focus on, so the effect of feedback specifically on sizes and angular momentum. So, of course, we're talking about galaxy formation in the context of CDM model, and here again, most people are familiar, but let me just stress a couple of different things. So we think that the mix of dark matter and baryons collapse from Gaussian fields, and we think we understand the features, the main features of this collapse pretty well. When it happens, the first initial dynamics is very similar for baryons and dark matter, and then as things get nonlinear, they separate, so the baryons go their own way, form a galaxy. Dark matter forms a dark matter halo. And this process is highly chaotic and nonlinear and involves a lot of mergers, which we usually see when we look at a picture like this. We see manifestation of these mergers in the presence of a lot of substructure in a distribution of dark matter. This is just this purple glow is dark matter particles colored by density. And the first thing that you notice in these pictures is ubiquity of lots of substructures, which are all these smaller halos that came in and merged with the main big halo that you see here. And the second thing that maybe not so obvious, but still is quite striking, if you look, if you pay attention, is the fact that there's no well-defined edge to the distribution of dark matter. That if you ask what are those halos that we're talking about when we talk about galaxy formation, galaxies forming halos, it's not very clear where the halo, well, when it begins, you can say, well, there's potential minimum here, but it's not very, very clear where it ends. Or in other words, the boundary is not very well defined.
Can I count scale?
Just a second. So what we talk about, when we talk about halos, we actually define something like a fairly arbitrary boundary. So in this case, we draw most often, sometimes people define it not necessarily with a spherical radius, but usually most often now the masses are defined as though halo is a spherical object with radius enclosing over density of something like 200 relative to critical or mean density of the universe. And you can see, given the distribution, again, you know, there's no obvious edge, so you can kind of guess that this definition is sort of arbitrary. Now, it turns out that there is both theoretical motivation for it, but also there is actually edge to the halos in a particular regime when they're actively forming. It's not the topic of my talk, but if you are interested in definitions of halos and halo radii, ask me afterwards or talk me afterwards. I have a lot to say about that particular topic. But for the purposes of this presentation, I'll be defining the halos using this definition that's fairly common in the literature, using the radius that encloses a sphere with the mean density equal to 200 times the critical density of the universe. Now,
which z is this? This is z.
This is a z at which you. It's a z at which you look at the object. So if I analyze halo at redshift 0.5, it's critical density at redshift 0.5. It's today. So now going back to Nick. So now that I define the scale here, the virial radius, I look at the galaxy here, and you have probably guessed that this is not a real simulation. It's a galaxy that was formed by what my advisor used to call a semi-graphical method of galaxy formation by photoshopping the galaxy into the halo simulation is real. The halo simulation is a real simulation, but this is actually some observed galaxy just photoshopped in for illustration purposes. And that's a kind of illustration of galaxies and halos that you see quite often, but when you see any such presentation where you actually see a galaxy compared to the size of the halo, you should know that it's wrong, that it's not correct, right? And what's wrong here? Yeah, it's not to scale, so the galaxy is too large. Actual galaxy, if you plotted the galaxy to scale, would look like this. You would barely see the disk, because the half-mass radius of stellar distribution is something like 1 to 4% of R200, this radius, that characteristic radius of the halo. So galaxies, that's a very important feature of galaxies, that galaxy, the variant distribution of galaxies is much, much smaller than the extent of Dechmere halo, or what we usually think the extent of Dechmere halo is. Even though initially baryons and Dechmere share the same dynamics, they move similarly in the beginning because they feel the same potential, the same dynamics. And yet somehow by the end of this process, galaxies end up in a very compact configuration here, whereas Dechmere is spread out. And of course, we think this happens by because baryons, after things go nonlinear and both Dechmere and baryons acquire a lot of energy, they dissipate the kinetic energy of collapse into sort of energy of random motions. Baryons can dissipate their energy through radiation and lose pressure support and condense towards the center, whereas Dechmere cannot do it, collisionless, so it keeps oscillating, retaining its initial energy of collapse, and that explains the difference in scales of the distribution. But if the second important, so this roughly the picture, but of course, if there was no angular momentum, then this size would be zero, everything would collapse to a point. Black hole, and the fact that galaxies actually do have size is due to angular momentum, which stops the collapse at some particular radius because the baryons then become rotationally supported. So the understanding the sizes of the galaxies and their connection to the angular momentum that the baryons acquire is a very important aspect of the whole picture of galaxy formation. That's going to be the subject of my talk. And you can, I'll explain to you right now where I derive this number, but you can kind of know if you know what the half mass radius, the scale length of the disk and half mass radius of the Milky Way is. We think Milky Way sits in 10 to 12, so you can kind of do the math and get the rough number for the Milky Way. You see that's in this ballpark. But it's actually true for all galaxies, not just for Milky Way, even for dwarfs, or even for brightest cluster galaxies. So let me explain how do we know that. So we now have large samples of galaxies that span a wide range of stellar masses due to various surveys, one of the most important of which in the last decade was Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and this is what you see here, the postage stamp collection of galaxies created by Mike and Blanton using SDSS data. And it's supposed to be representative. So the galaxies are selected randomly from the bins and luminosities. And luminosity here goes this way, and it's the postage stamps represent equal step in log luminosity. Right. So as you go up, you essentially make an equal steps in log luminosity. L star is around here. And the color is on the y-axis, but color is not what I'm going to be talking about here. And you can see that as galaxies get brighter, they also get larger because each postage stamp corresponds to the same physical size. So you can compare galaxy sizes visually across this range. So as things get brighter, galaxies get larger, but you can also see that this relation is not power law because even though there is an overall trend with luminosity, you can see that low luminosities, there's barely any trend, right? So if you look at this galaxy, this galaxy, this galaxy, you step in log L, but the sizes barely change, right? So there is not much change here, so the relation is very shallow between the size and luminosity. And then suddenly you get to L star and it picks up. Immediately galaxies become larger. So just for looking at this postage stamp image, you know that relation between size and luminosity, and roughly it can be thought as relation size and stellar mass, is very shallow at low luminosities and becomes steeper at high luminosities.
Which is actually been, which of the two has actually been, I appreciate they're both increasing from left to right, but which of,
where Mike or whoever made this picture made it, what it's in this bin luminosity, right. So here's, so you see this trend visually. Here is it, you can see it quantitatively, where I collected a bunch of different samples of disk galaxies shown in blue, spheroidal galaxies shown in red. There are also lines that represent mean relations for large samples, subsamples of galaxies from Sloan. This is late type galaxies from Bernardi et al. 2016, and this is early type galaxies. And this is half mass radius defined in 3D, not in 2D projection. So to compare disks and spheroidals on equal footing, I essentially convert the half mass radius that encloses half of the stars into three-dimensional, deprojected. Then I don't have to worry about morphology. And then I can plot spheroidal and disk galaxies from the same plot. And you can see here the entire galaxy population from dwarf spheroidals. You can see the sizes here, a few tenths of parsecs, half mass radii, These are shown by the cartwheels, then the dwarf irregulars and dwarf ellipticals, then normal disks here and normal ellipticals, Milky Way is a star here, and all the way to the brightest cluster galaxies you see here. And you can see that at all masses, galaxies follow kind of a trend with some scatter, but there is a tight correlation, and it's a not a power law. Right? It looks quite complicated. It looks shallow here, as you saw in the previous postage stamp image, then steepens. And then maybe even steepens again if here, although there are not that many galaxies, and it's mostly dwarf spheroidal in a local group, so we don't have a good statistic here. But overall, it's not a power law. It's very clear, right? So the correlation is there, but it's complicated. Now, I told you that sizes are 1 to 2% of the video radius, so how do I know that? And we can convert from stellar mass to video radius using the relation between stellar mass and halo mass. This is something that's by now quite well established. We have a bunch of different observations which tell us that the stellar mass of the central galaxy correlates with the total halo mass of the surrounding dark matter halos. This has been calibrated in the last few years using a variety of techniques, several weak lensing studies shown by circles, satellite kinematics shown by the triangles here. These points is something that comes from clusters of galaxies where stellar masses are measured from optical or IR data, and halo masses for individual systems are measured using X-ray data. And you can see that galaxies of the different masses follow a sequence, which is also non-power law. So it's also steep and then shallows. And it's quite different from the dotted line, which is would be a relation if galaxies were just converting all of the available universal fractional baryons into stars. So then the relation would be linear and normalization corresponding to universal baryon fraction in the universe. Now, this, of course, is very familiar because it's this difference between this line and this correlation that we observe, which we think is due to feedback. Right? Even at the closest point of separation, there's a factor of 4 or so difference in normalization, which means that the galaxies contain about 25% or 20 to 30% of the baryons that we potentially should be available to them.
No, they convert 25% of baryons into stars.
That's right. I said that galaxies. Galaxies contain 25% of the baryons potentially available to the halo. What's wrong with that statement?
Well, they may contain a universal baryon fraction.
In what form? I said No, the stellar. Okay, so gas fractions here 10%. I mean, Milky Way has 10%.
No, I
say galaxy. Galaxy. I didn't say halo. I said galaxy. Right. Well, this is stellar mass. It's something that you measure in optical. So, of course, as you go to smaller masses, this difference becomes more than another magnitude. Very quickly increases both at smaller mass and at large masses. And we think feedback should be doing that. And I'll show you results. I'll show you. Actually, we saw a lot of results in the conference that this can be explained by feedback if feedback is sufficiently efficient. But for the current purposes, what matters is that there is a correlation and that we have now a fairly good calibration of it. Now, I should say that there are lines here. The lines are not the fits. The lines are results of a simple ansatz in which we essentially assume that every galaxy in the universe is inside the dark halo. Reasonable, right? That's what comes out from our paradigm of galaxy formation. And then we can derive relations between stellar mass and halo masses just by assuming that abundance of galaxies of a given stellar mass should correspond to abundance of halos of a given mass. You can assume scatter. It gives you a non-parametric relation between the stellar mass and halo mass, and you can solve that equation numerically. And the solution you see as lines here. The solution will depend on the scatter, what you assume about the scatter in this relation. So different lines correspond to different assumptions. Dotted one, no scatter. This one was with scatter, but then if you average in different directions. For small masses, the scatter doesn't make much difference, so it doesn't really matter. What matters is that this simple ansatz tracks, even though it's not designed, it's not a fitting function, it tracks what we actually measure from observations pretty well, even though the error bars are quite large. But within these error bars, it matches the data pretty well, which means that this basic assumption that all galaxies in the observable universe are in dark matter halos works pretty well. So we can take either some analytic fit to this observed relation or this abundance matching ansatz, which is consistent with it, and use it to convert stellar masses into halo masses using a simple procedure. You take stellar mass-halo mass relation for a galaxy of a given stellar mass, you compute the halo mass, and then radius is by definition is related one-to-one to halo mass. And so you can use to convert stellar mass to halo radius and then get this correlation, right? So you take this, convert stellar masses to halo radii, and replot it as size virial relation. Right? Then you get this. Instead of this very non-parallel relation, which gets from shallow to steep slope, you get something not just close to parallel, but actually to parallel of linear slope. The dashed line here that you see going through the points is not the best fit. It's just, although if you do formal fit, you get something very close to it. It's just a linear relation shown for comparison, with dotted lines showing the scatter that is expected within a simple model that I'll talk about using what we know about spins of Dechmere halos, the scatter of angular momentum that should be acquired during collapse of halos. Right, so essentially all this bending you've straightened if you convert it from stellar mass to halo mass. What does it mean? It means that all of the nonlinear and non-power law behavior in the size stellar mass relation just comes from the non-power law behavior of stellar mass halo mass. The actual relation between sizes of galaxies and halo masses and sizes and radii is power law. And I think this could be used as a good argument to argue that this is a primary correlation. What we see as a size stellar mass correlation is just a consequence of nonlinear relation between stellar mass and halo mass. Okay. Now, if you look at this carefully, you can and play devil's advocate. And I'm surprised Nick is not asking about this. You can say, well, but at high masses, actually, you know, if you look at subsamples, so like for example these galaxies, you can see that around L star, for example, the slope is not quite linear. Also, if you look at the high mass, you know, you can ask, well, the galaxies here seem to be steeper than linear. So yeah, so there are deviations for subsamples of galaxies from linear relation. It's only linear if you look at the galaxy population as a whole, from dwarf spheroidals to massive ellipticals. But it's still quite remarkable, right? So it tells you that dwarf spheroidals, the half-mass radius for them, is roughly the same fraction of the virial radius as for very massive ellipticals. Right? That's quite interesting. But what about this?
Just again, so R200 is just current redshift.
Current redshift,
no
right.
Correction.
So here, right. So here is it's a good, yeah.
And just a quick thing on the dwarf spheroidals, but we know that they are tightly, you know, they lost a lot of matter, so they have mm-hmm. actual radius now. And also, like, it was much smaller than the immediate radius. So I'm not sure that it makes sense to put them in.
Yeah, so this was done I did it for fun. I agree that there are all kind of reasons. Also, you can expect that abundance match will break down at this regime. So
stars are not tightly affected, right? So it's
still debated.
Like,
so I was kind of debating whether to cut it here or show this. I mean, yeah. So
yeah,
they're caveat emptor, but you know they still kind of fall roughly in there. Right?
The simplicity of Andre's approach is its strength, right? Because you're taking a quantity representative of the radius of the halo and a quantity representative of the radius of the galaxies and just using a balance matching to correlate them. So I'm not sure that it necessarily answers about the strength.
So for example, everything you say may just create this scatter, right? So,
yeah.
Because we don't know what the demand is. Because the scatter is, you know, it's a factor of two here, right? It's like if you look from this line to this, you know, it's quite significant. So maybe tidal effect just scattered around.
R200 here? I mean, from what? R200 is the real radius of the halo. Before
it came in. Yeah. So I should say that's right. For all the satellite galaxies, so it's plotted here. So abundance matching actually converts to halo radius, not that you have today inside the bigger halo. It's that before it came in, right? What would it have if it was isolated? Right.
So when you plot the things and the little things, I mean, for like the dwarf irregulars, I mean, we're no longer in this regime where most of the disk baryons are stars, right? They have high gas fractions.
Mm-hmm.
But the radius of 21 centimeter emission is probably a factor of 10 larger than the radius of the stars.
Actually, it turns out to be only a factor of 2. In the paper, actually, I did look at the gas as well. And it turns out that gas is just a constant fraction. So the disk, the scale length of the disk in the gas is just a constant factor with some scatter with the stellar. And that's something that people have seen before, but you could see it for these galaxies as well. So if you added gas, essentially what you would do is that you would just shift some of these points up. And I think that's maybe would shift some of the blue points here somewhat up.
It would change the slope, because I think for late type spirals, maybe it's a factor of 2.
No, I checked it for all these galaxies. I checked it for all the galaxies. All the blue points that you see here have a constant offset, a constant factor between gas scale lengths and the stellar.
There's a lot of variation between galaxies.
Yeah, that shows a scatter, but the average doesn't change with stellar mass of the galaxy.
I'm understanding this R200 at z equals zero.
Yes. If each object was isolated.
If.
Yeah, R200, it would have if it was isolated today. Right.
Yeah, but it's today, not at the time of
formation. Yeah,
that's right. And so you know, if you look at this, if you ask, well, what about this high mass end, which looks steeper? So to interpret things like this, like some relatively second order deviations from this overall linear trend, we have to look at actual dependence on redshift and how things evolve. One thing that we have to worry about in particular is something we call pseudo-evolution. Most people, in my experience, don't know what this means. So let me just use a couple of minutes to explain it, because it also is important if you want to compare simulations to this relation as well. So it was found already 7 years ago that if you look at Milky Way-sized galaxies today, Milky Way-sized halos and smaller mass, you essentially find that those halos do not accrete much mass today at all. And actually, that's true even for redshift 1. So between redshift 1 and 0, they essentially stop their accretion. So these halos just sit in there, mostly formed by redshift 1, and just doing nothing, essentially, not accreting anymore. Right? You can see it explicitly if you look at the radial velocity. This is mean radial velocity. In halos, here you use peak height, but essentially peak height is related to mass. The Milky Way is somewhere here. For example, this is dwarf galaxies. These are clusters, the high peak heights. And you can see that the halos form a sequence. So high peak height objects, so corresponding to clusters today, they do show negative radial velocity. This is Hubble flow, by the way, here. And then there is a region where you see negative velocity. It means that gas isn't falling on average onto the halo. The halo is growing, accreting mass. But if you go to a Milky Way mass, so its last two lines here, you can see that it barely dips below zero. It means that whatever it accretes is very, very small amount, so very small accretion. And the dwarf halos never go into negative. They essentially stay zero, so the material is in equilibrium, and then it smoothly joins into Hubble flow. It means that they accrete nothing, which is zero. Right? So if they don't accrete nothing, it means that the density distribution just sits as static in equilibrium. So if you look at the mass profile, so this is mass enclosed in a given radius, actually, but instead of radius, it shows you enclosed over density, just because we typically relate halo radius to over density. If the halo is not doing anything, but we tied our mass definition to critical or mean density of the universe, it means that as time goes on, our radius definition just changes. And if object doesn't evolve physically, for example, size doesn't change, the halo radius will still change due to definition. Right, just because the mass distribution is smooth. It doesn't have a well-defined boundary, as I showed you visually in the slide. So you'll just force to march in radius down this smooth density profile, even though nothing changes in the halo. And that actually creates, that corresponds to change of mass of a factor of 2. In all semi-energetic models, and often in simulations, that increase of mass is interpreted as physical accretion. That's wrong. This plot shows that it doesn't correspond to physical accretion. It's just definitional, so change of mass by a factor of 2 between ratio 1 and 0 for objects like Milky Way and smaller mass is just definitional. It doesn't correspond to physical accretion. If we want to interpret this size virial relation, we actually have to correct for this, because the size doesn't care about our definition of halo mass. If it's settled to ratio 1, it will stay the same, right? But halo radius will be forced to change. So we have to actually take into account the fact that the highest mass objects in the previous plot, which was sitting in clusters, these objects are still growing on average, and these guys don't grow at all, right? So these guys essentially tell us what is the relation between the size of the galaxy and virial radius for objects that are actually physically evolving, whereas here, these sizes were set some time ago, and then virial radius was just changing because of definition, right? We have to correct for this. There is a simple way. I won't go into detail of how this correction is done for radius, but I can explain. If somebody is curious, I can explain it. A bit later, we're actually writing a paper discussing how this can be corrected. There is a fairly simple correction which can be done statistically, not object per object, because object per object, it requires actually knowing mass accretion history. But statistically, you can correct for it. So if you do that, you get this relation, which is still close to linear because correction is relatively small, but it actually makes this steepening at high masses mostly disappear. So now all galaxies stay roughly at the same fraction of the virial radius, and that fraction is something like 4%. Again, this is not the best fit, just roughly fit by eye. This line here corresponds to 4% of R200.
Okay. Are these the dotted lines supposed to be the expected 1 sigma scatter?
2 sigma. It's a scatter that I'll actually, it's my next slide, but it's a scatter that you expect if you take a simple scenario where angular momentum is acquired during collapse, and baryons have similar angular momentum that Dekmer acquires, something that we've studied very extensively in simulations.
Does it mean that the exercise half life radius scales linearly with RS instead of R200?
Yes, roughly that's what it means, because in this case, essentially what it does is that it brings all objects, it corrects all objects into this stage of evolution when they're physically accreting, and at that stage we know that RS is a constant fraction, or constant, the virial radius is a constant factor with respect to scale radius of the halo, which is about 4. So you can either say that it's linear with RS, but it's also in this stage, it's also linear with R200 as well. So it doesn't matter.
Oh, but there is C is a function of M, right? So then.
Not in this regime. In this regime, it's flat. It's almost flat.
Because C is a function of M just because of this pseudo evolution.
So when halos grow fast, concentration actually doesn't grow. It just stays at a constant fraction at about 4. And so, the size correlates with scale radius. In this case, means that concentration is virial radius divided by scale radius of the halo, and that is constant, right? So it means the size is either proportional to scale radius over to R200 linearly. So let me talk about these dotted lines. So this linear relation between size and virial radius is actually expected if size is simply related to specific angular momentum of baryons. So if we know the origin of angular momentum, that's actually no mystery, because the origin of angular momentum was worked out actually well before CDM in the early 70s by Daraskevich, who noted that for generic Gaussian initial field, the peaks are not spherical, just statistical statement, and when non-spherical peak collapses and the distribution around it is inhomogeneous, some random collection of other peaks, it has a dipole moment, and it will be torqued by surrounding density distribution. And that's something you can compute analytically of how this happens. So and you find that by the end of the collapse process, the collapsing peak will acquire a small amount of angular momentum. It's relatively small, but non-zero. This was all worked out in the 70s, early 80s, how much angular momentum would be acquired during collapse. Later simulations show that picture is more or less correct. So the tidal torques that are experienced by halo are of the magnitude that's predicted by these analytical models. And so there's no mystery about where baryons and Dekmer acquire the angular momentum during collapse. And throughout 30 years of simulations of Dekmer, this amount of angular momentum that is acquired was quantified quite well. Usually it's expressed in this parameter lambda, which is called spin. And the lambda is defined as follows. So it's defined, say, at radius R200, it corresponds to a factor between the specific angular momentum which will be required to make everything rotationally supported at R200. Right? So if material would be coming in with angular momentum that would make it immediately rotationally supported at R200, then lambda would be unity. Right? So this is actual angular momentum, but this is what would be required for angular support. And this circular velocity is defined as square root of gm over r, and so we can rewrite it as a function of halo mass using the definition relation between m200 and r200. So you expect that specific angular momentum, if lambda is constant, just scales as 2/3 power of halo mass. Then you can say, well, if lambda is not zero, is not one, it's something smaller, then you can predict that the collapse will be stopped when the specific angular momentum of the baryons is equal to whatever it had at J200, and that can relate radius at which you stop the collapse due to angular momentum support to R200, so you'll have a linear relation with lambda as a proportionality constant, and this factor that relates the circular velocity at the radius where baryon stops and at R200. So this depends on the shape of rotation curve. So if this is roughly constant, is independent of halo mass, and this quantity is roughly constant, then you expect linear correlation in the size of the galaxy and R200. Turns out that simulations show that this quantity doesn't depend on halo mass, so it is constant. It actually doesn't depend on almost anything. People try to find correlations of spin with any property of halos, and it's very difficult. Some weak correlations were found, but nothing really major. And this quantity is not quite constant, but it's close enough to constant that you get something quite close to linear relation. There are, in fact, factors here that depend on various other things. That was worked out first by Michael and George Stassi, and then also a couple other papers was greatly popularized and updated for NFW profiles by Momar and White in 98. Despite the complications, you can put extra factors. In the end, what you get from all these factors is something close to linear relation in size of galaxy in R200. And as I just showed you, that's actually what observed galaxies seem to show. Now, the surprise is that originally these models, at least that's my understanding, were developed for disk galaxies, because for them, it makes sense that everything is rotating, you know, everything is in rotational support. But if you look back at this correlation for observed galaxies, you can see that it's followed actually for both by both ellipticals, by both spheroidals and disks. So that fact is surprising. Like, for example, even BCGs, you would never think to be rotationally supported or the size has been determined by angular momentum. It's still like close to this relation if you correct for pseudo-evolution.
So what, I mean, why is it surprising to know that stars form disks?
Well, it's surprising because, Nick, when we discussed it first, you were surprised. And then when we figured it out, now it's not surprising to you. I can ask people, I mean, does it sound surprising to you that ellipticals and spiral follow the same correlation?
But there's no, I mean, still rotators have no rotational support.
No, but they're better
than that. I'm just playing the game.
So how many people find it unsurprising? Obvious. You think it's obvious that ellipticals should?
I think it's surprising.
You think it's surprising?
Yeah.
So how many people are surprised by this? Okay.
I think you need to sit down and think about it.
Okay, the reason Nick thinks it's unsurprising because we already discussed it and figured out how to explain it, well, roughly how to explain it. So now it's not surprising.
If there's no connection to this whatsoever.
Well, it's in your subconsciousness, I'm pretty sure.
Ultimately, whether the orbits have been completely disrupted in a merger, the distance of those stars from the central potential well was determined by this process.
Yeah, so essentially.
So it's recorded.
I think, I mean, what I would have expected to see, a steeper slope in the sense that, you know, the ellipticals would be more offset from the other ones. And you still have some correlation, but not as strong as.
Well, that's what I should say, that when I started looking at this, I was fully expecting just disks for this to work for disks, and it kind of worked. And just out of the blue, I decided to plot from Bernardi's sample to plot the same correlation for ellipticals, and I got this line.
Exactly.
And I'm like, what the hell is that? You know, this, I mean, in fact, ellipticals are even closer to linear than spiral. So, so that was surprising. But I think if you think about what sets the size? So we usually think about, angular momentum determining sizes of galaxies when something rotates nicely and coherently. But in fact, ellipticals, what happens is that individual elements are still orbiting, right? They're not rotating, but they're orbiting. And the size, the extent of the orbit is defined by energy and angular momentum of the orbit. It just what happens is that each orbit is misaligned, so they are in different directions, but the extent of the orbit is still sensitive to the angular momentum, right? So it's not that surprising that angular momentum affects the sizes of ellipticals, if you think about it this way. But nevertheless, it's not something, definitely not something I expected when I started looking into this. I should say that it was known since 1983 that both ellipticals and spirals do follow a relation that's quite close to what you expect in this simple model. That's something that Michael was pointing out in 1983. He talked about it 2 weeks ago. Nice thing about KTP that you can go back for those who weren't here, you can go back and listen to the talk. The main point is that if you actually measure specific angular momentum for stars in spiral galaxies that are these, well, the latest types are these magenta points, and ellipticals are the open circles and these cyan circles, you get a correlation that is quite close to what you expect, which is shown by these dotted lines, from the simple scaling with halo mass that you expect from the simple model, except that ellipticals and spirals are offset. So the factor, constant proportionality factor that enters here is different. The reason you see it as non power law here is, again, because it's plotted here as a function of stellar mass. And the relation between stellar mass and halo mass is not a power law, so you introduce a kink in this relation. If you actually plotted these points as a function of halo mass, it would be consistent with the power law of the slope. Right? So both these galaxies and ellipticals are consistent with the scaling predicted by the simple model, but they do have different offset. Now, in size, they don't have this huge offset. They have a little, they have some, but they don't have huge. And I think that's where the difference between the specific angular momentum that is sensitive to relative orientation of the orbits. In principle, you can have size setting angular momentum setting size of the galaxy, but then individual orbital elements completely randomly aligned, which means that the total specific angular momentum is zero. So you can drive this coordinate to zero completely, right? But the size will still be finite. So it's not zero for ellipticals, but it's much smaller than for spirals. In fact, I think the factor is 4.65 between them. So ellipticals are consistent with this proportionality, but they look like they're different from spirals, mostly in how the angular momentum of individual baryon mass elements is aligned. Now, I should say that simulations, what about simulations? Simulations, recent simulations started to show that galaxies that form in them also follow this relation. This is a specific angular momentum as a function of halo mass from a relatively recent paper by Laura Sales et al. 2010. They simulate a bunch of galaxies. The medians for the galaxies are shown by lines. Individual lines show gas, stars, and this is all baryons shown by blue. And the line here is this predicted scaling of m to 2/3. The dark matter follows that scaling, not surprisingly. And then what's more surprising, the galaxies also follow it, even though there is an offset of a factor of 2 to 3 in this particular simulation. The simulations reproduce the scaling, but they show that there is an offset. In other words, that baryons lose specific angular momentum that they acquire during collapse. But the amount of this loss actually depends on how you do the feedback. And that's where I make connection to feedback. This is results from two studies in 2008, Zavala et al. And Scanapieco et al., where they looked at evolution of angular momentum in this case, or specific angular momentum in this case, for objects forming the same halo, but with different treatment of feedback. What you see here is early evolution, which is just described by a linear torque theory. So these baryons and halos acquire angular momentum. You can see that they actually, I think, yeah, this is specific angular momentum, so it's not angular momentum. The baryons and dark matter share specific angular momentum. They acquire the same amount. That's how we expect when they co-evolve. Then nonlinear things start to happen. And in this particular simulation where feedback is weak, baryons lose a lot of angular momentum in the end through nonlinear interactions. In simulations with feedback, they lose some. So this is dark matter, this is baryon, but very little, small amount. Then in the end, the baryons still end up with angular momentum comparable to dark matter. The same feature you see here, the same behavior you see here. Initially, everything is the same. Then with simulation with no feedback, baryons lose a lot of angular momentum. Simulation with feedback, they lose some, but relatively little. And you can see that, again, it's the same halo. You can see that the final morphology depends a lot on what happens. So it tells you that, you know, your loss of angular momentum, the angular momentum that you end up with, is tightly correlated with the morphology of the galaxy that you
use. Is it the same scale in this sense?
I think so, yeah.
So why is it logic for loss of angular momentum?
I don't think you can say because this is burnt out here, so you don't know how much mass is in this yellow.
You have much more stars.
You have much more stars, but also it's burnt out, so I'll show you that actually what you end up with is a smaller size, not larger size. So it's just visual appearance.
The yellow star is smaller.
That's right. So if you actually measure half mass radius, you'll find that it's smaller here than here. So I think this. Difficulty that simulations were having over the last 20 years in forming late-type galaxies is very clearly related to the fact that the angular momentum loss after the initial collapse was treated incorrectly in the simulations. So if in simulations where feedback does whatever it does to prevent loss of angular momentum, you also end up with much more disky galaxies. Right? So for the remaining of the time, so for the next 5 to 10 minutes, I'll show you results of our work on our simulations where we look at this as well in simulation of galaxy formation where we use a feedback model that is quite efficient, at least for some combination of parameters, quite efficient for in driving winds. So what we do here is something that is described in a paper with Oscar, actually Nick, Sam Leitner a couple of years ago. This model introduces, instead of releasing energy or momentum in a single burst, as was most often done previously. What we're trying to do is we try to use results of stellar population synthesis models, such as Starburst 99, that predict the amount of energy and angular momentum that Young star populations can inject into surrounding gas. So what you see here, probably not very well, essentially power, the amount of energy that's radiated by radiation as star population evolves, this is 10 to 4, 10 to 5, 10 to 6. So you can see the supernova occupies the time range from 3 million years to about 40 million years. But even before supernova, you have a lot of energy injected by winds, by stellar winds. And that injection pretty much starts where stars have been formed. And the amount is very similar to what you inject by supernova. But also, there's lots of radiation. So if you can tap into this radiation reservoir, as was argued by Norm Murray, Elliott, and others, you can actually also inject a lot of momentum through radiation pressure. Now, winds themselves also inject momentum. This is something that people in this room are working on. When winds create bubble, the hot bubble is highly pressurized, so you start pushing the gas and imparting angular momentum. The amount of angular momentum you impart in this way, in this stage and in subsequent blast waves driven by supernova, is something of order of a few times luminosity of stars over C. So it's quite a bit of angular momentum. So what we're trying to do in this model essentially is to capture the injection of energy due to supernova and winds, but also momentum due to winds, supernova, and potential radiation. I won't go into details of how this model is implemented. It's described in our paper, but also if you go back to conference, which happened 3 weeks ago, you can find Oscar's talk where he goes into more details of this model. The main thing is that this is done in time-resolved manner, so that when stars formed and before supernova explode, you inject a lot of energy and momentum due to early stellar populations through stellar winds and radiation pressure. Important ingredient also is that star formation is based on the local abundance of molecular hydrogen, which is calculated using an equilibrium model of Krumhoff, McKee, and Tomlinson, which Nick and Mark showed that reproduces quite well the actual calculations when you track the hydrogen formation destruction through equations. And it's parameterized in a fairly standard way where we assume that the timescale for star formation is can be parameterized through efficiency per freefall time. This is freefall time, and this efficiency is a parameter that we are worrying. The model for molecular hydrogen itself, all parameters are fixed, we don't worry them, but efficiency, we try different values. Ingredient that's quite important is the fact that when supernova inject energy, we assume that some fraction of that energy goes into turbulent motions that don't radiate away immediately, so they are retained. They're retained on a timescale of 10 million years, so they're dissipated rather on a timescale of 10 million years, but we decouple the timescale from the cooling timescale. That turns out to be quite a significant source of additional pressure in the disk and thickens the disk by a factor of several, lowers its density, and so slows down star formation rate, which turns out to be quite important, especially at high redshifts. It doesn't by itself drive winds, but it makes the density of the disk lower, so it affects star formation.
That time scale is an absolute time scale, or it's
scaled? Yeah, so here we just assume that it's 10 million years, yeah. And 10 million years is chosen as turbulence decay time for typical GMC density, so that's roughly why this was chosen. So to give you an idea about how violent the feedback can be in this model, let's see if it works. Okay. You can see the evolution of temperature here. This is high redshift, so redshift 7, but already, and you're looking at a region of 270 kiloparsec around the progenitor of the Milky Way. You can see that there is very strong blast waves being driven. The temperatures here at blue is 10 to the 4, red is million degrees, and it's immediately. Even a small mass progenitor start to fill large volumes with ejecta. An interesting piece is that at some points at redshift 4 and 3, we seem to see relatively cold winds being driven. You can see some material that's been cold, been ejected. How this happens is not completely clear, but it looks like in some instances, the entire ISM of the galaxy gets ejected and without actually being heated, just driven by pressure blast waves. Here's a hot outflow, for example. Here's another hot outflow, but they sometimes are followed by outflows of relatively cold material, like here.
But then, individual galaxies, dwarf-sized galaxies.
So these are dwarfs, right? You can see they don't drive very much outflow. I think they are not very well resolved there in the simulation. But yeah, so. So in the end, this main guy will form a Milky Way-sized galaxy, right? So. It's a progenitor of L-star galaxy today. At that time, I don't know if it's L-star or not, probably not very far. So you can see a lot of dynamics, a lot of interactions, which happen, of course, regardless of feedback. But the feedback here adds this very violent component, which ejects a lot of material from the simulation.
Are episodes individual events that the simulation is generating, or are they sort of the result of build-up and sudden releasing to the atmosphere?
It's both. So, for example, here when things quiet down, so this ratio 1.3, you can see that the mergers have become rare. The disk is rotating, but you can see like flashes there, like fireworks going on. So those fireworks are individual star forming events that drive blast waves, but they are no longer strong enough to really drive kind of large scale outflow. But at early times when mergers were significant, you have a combination of factors that sometimes just leads to a runaway burst of star formation and blowing up of the entire ISM. So it's pretty violent.
So Andre, do you have a sense, is it the calming down of the merger history or the transition to pseudo-evolution that's making it settle down at late time?
That's right. So I'll come back to this. But this time it's already pseudo-evolving. I mean, you can see that, of course, some things do happen still, like a gas era, you know, coming in and so on. But halo is largely stopped growing at that point.
And is it true that you kind of only get the nice semi-ordered disks in that later stage?
No, it's actually even before. It's just that it gets more and more ordered. And how ordered it is actually depends on feedback. I'll show you a little. So essentially what we did in this paper that was recently, just a month ago, submitted, we simulated the same Milky Way progenitor with the same object, the same halo potential, but varying parameters of the simulations, not everything, but the most important ones, and excluding or including the various pieces of feedback physics. So, for example, what you're looking at is those different simulations for star formation rate as a function of redshift for the main progenitor of that. Actually, it's not main progenitor, it's everything that ends up in the final galaxy. And the shaded areas here is this empirical derivation of what we think the star formation rate should be from Beruzzi et al. 2016. The lines themselves are simulations with different parameters. So if you look at the blue line at the top, this is a simulation where no feedback processes were included at all. And the two simulations were run with different efficiency of star formation for freefall time, 1% and 10%. You know, if you're interested why 10%, well, it's consistent. It actually is consistent with what we see in even though people usually talk about 1% per freefall time. If you actually look at what GMCs tell us, for many GMCs, efficiency is actually close to 10%. So in other words, it's scattered somewhere between these two values. So both of them are quite reasonable. But what's interesting is that if you don't include any feedback, both of the simulation, either 1% or 10%, kind of they overestimate this by a factor of 10. And even at late times, they kind of converge to the same star formation rate, so you don't see much difference. Somehow gases are readjusting themselves so that they produce the same star formation rate, which is quite a bit higher than what we think it should be. Right? So what we consider a fiducial model is when we include all the feedback processes, and we use efficiency per star formation of 10%, that's shown by the solid line. And you can see that that line, well, that's why we call it fiducial, it kind of tracks this inferred star formation history pretty well. Yeah.
The efficiency that you're quoting here is the local.
Local efficiency.
If you were to average over the efficiency, the efficiency would be much larger, even though you have 1%.
I'm not sure I understand. In terms of Kennicott relation, Kennicott relation, naively, if you interpret its normalization, it does imply efficiency per freefall term of order like 0.25% to 0.5%. But what's interesting is that if we assume local efficiency of 10% and then look at kiloparsec scales, in this particular simulation where feedback is efficient in driving outflows,
I think when there's no feedback,
then you, for 1%, you will reproduce the Kennicott relation. For 10%, it will be much higher. Yeah, if there's no feedback. Is this what you're asking or not?
I'm asking if this number you're quoting is on the level of your individual cells.
Yes, that's right.
Now, if you average over the whole entire galaxy, you have redshift, like let's say redshift 6, for instance, and I ask you what is the efficiency there, is it still 1%?
Yeah, so in the regime where feedback is weak, the efficiency on global scale is roughly the same as you put on local scale. We didn't look at the galaxy as a whole, but we looked at Kennicott relation, and there the normalization just scales with what you assume locally if feedback is weak. When feedback is efficient, then that scaling is broken. So then you can increase local efficiency by a factor of 10, but Kennicott relation more or less stays still at the same value, which made me believe that the Kennicott, the normalization of Kennicott relation is, in general, should be decoupled from what you assume at local efficiency. At least we see that it can be decoupled in simulations. The gas is redistributing itself in such a way that it arrives at a low efficiency on large scales, even though you assume a high efficiency on small scales. That's something we see. It's something that we've seen in fire simulations by Phil and collaborators. That's something that's quite remarkable, I think, one of the most remarkable features, that once you get into this regime of efficient feedback, things are starting to rearrange themselves, that the properties on large scale become decoupled about what you do and assume on small scales. But that's not true if feedback is weak. When feedback is weak, then things just scale with what you assume on small scales.
Just a few words, just how you did the weighting of feedback in this
guy. Essentially, we have a subgrid model that, you know, if the star formation recipe predicts how the mass of young stars that form in a given cell, then we have a subgrid model that assumes that this stellar mass is distributed in star clusters with a mass function of m minus 2 or close to it. And for each star cluster, we look at what observations tell us about the average density of gas clumps around those star clusters, observations tell us surface density. And then we essentially assume that the momentum is injected proportional to the surface density of those clumps. And L over C that the stars will emit, which is given by starburst 99.
So it's all just momentum injection.
We also inject energy due to wind. So some of the energy is injected thermally, and then momentum is injected proportional at a rate proportional to L over C with the factor that's computed by subgrid model.
There isn't like a radio transfer code?
No, there's no radio transfer, no. Just so we assume that radiation pressure just, most of the effect just happens locally on a subgrid scale. And that imparts momentum, but then we don't impart momentum on a large scale interaction.
Do you know what the relative
non-thermal
energy deposited versus kinetic energy deposited is roughly?
Most of the energy is momentum corresponds to a small fraction of energy. So I don't know the exact fractions, but most of the energy is thermal. Yeah. But there is a big difference because momentum you don't radiate away. You can cancel, but you don't radiate away. So it still has a large effect. The main effect that happens due to this momentum injection is that the dense gas from which stars form acquires angular momentum, and it starts to kind of disperse, starts to flow out. And so by the time that supernovae explode, they explode in much lower density, often also not just lower density, but also kind of porous medium. And so the energy that you inject by supernova suffer much less radiative cooling losses. And that seems to be where it makes it much. For example, we have one run where we switch off radiative feedback, and so you can compare this magenta line to solid line. So the only difference between the black solid and magenta is that you don't have radiation this early momentum injection. And you can see that, well, it's not too far, it's not as far as no feedback, but it's still factor of several offset here, especially at early times. Now, early times are very critical because that's if you overdo your star formation at early times, this is the time when there are frequent mergers. So if you form more stars at early times, it means that you're going to form a larger bulge. Because once those stars merge into bulge, there's no way to unmerge them. You know, you'll form a spheroid. So the amount of star formation that happens in these early times first determines the amount of angular momentum that the baryons, the final galaxy, will have, and second will determine how big a bulge it will be. And the...
I had a comment on that, because in Eris, for example, it would be more like the orange lines, would be a bulge.
Yeah.
But we form a big disk with a very small bulge, so it cannot be...
But it's still, if you look at Aquila, they find a very clear correlation in different simulations, that the mass of the bulge, the fraction of stellar mass in the bulge is tightly correlated with the redshift at which you form anticorrelated with redshift at which you form half of the stars. So in other words, the more stars you form early on, the bigger the bulge will form.
Say that again, probably.
The more stars you form at early times, the bigger the bulge you end up with. Maybe Eris is somewhere within the scatter of that.
It's an adequate yes, because of the asymmetry is a big part.
And that just happens because, you know, at that time, as you can see in the movie, there's lots of mergers going on. And if mergers are stellar, then you form a spheroid. If mergers are gaseous, if you actually suppress star formation, then the gaseous mergers, as is now well known, can reform a disk. So the key is not forming spheroid during the period of active accretion is to keep gas gaseous, which means that star formation should be suppressed. And that's also interesting. I mean, we don't know how true this line is, right? But at least taking at face value, that's also what observations tell us star formation should be in this scale. It should be quite low. If you, this is a Milky Way progenitor. If you look at redshift 3 or 4, you find that star formation had was roughly one solar mass per year, which means that it's the same as today. We tend to think about galaxies forming very actively stars in the past, but you know, Milky Way, according to this inference, should have formed stars at the same rate at redshift 3 as it is today. In fact, if that's true, then when we look at Hubble Ultra Deep Field, we actually don't see Milky Way progenitors. Everything we see there is progenitors of more massive galaxies, because that star formation rate is a bit, is kind of from the edge of detectable in the Hubble Ultra Deep Field.
Yeah, but that's true, because you know that there's the past history in the past, at least for the redshift 1, Milky Way didn't change very much star formation rate.
Yeah. Well, there are multiple evidence here that for Milky Way galaxies, something like 80% of the stellar mass is formed after redshift 2. Right, so only 20% at early times.
But here, between redshift 0 and redshift 1, you have a lower magnitude of star formation.
Sorry, what?
Between redshift 0 and redshift 1, you have
a
star formation rate varies by lower magnitude.
That's right. So well, but that's the inference. I mean, they're talking about shaded areas?
Yeah.
Well, this inference from essentially, it's not abundance matching, but it's this empirical model where galaxies are merged to halos.
I thought that
I don't think it's thought that Milky Way star formation rate was. I think maybe that was thought when the star formation rate was thought to be like 3-4 solar mass per year. I mean, that was revised to 1-1.5 solar mass per year.
Well, when you talk to people like James Peter, for instance, they'll tell you that it doesn't vary by more than a factor 2.
Well, then I would. I mean, I don't know exactly, but I mean, maybe a factor of 2 will be still within that scalar.
How this inference comes out? I don't know what you use to do this inference.
I mean, I cannot claim that what we're forming here is the Milky Way. What I can say that we're forming something in the Milky Way size halo. But of course, within.
And the other is supposed to be an observational.
Yeah, the shaded lines.
Excuse me as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's
what's confusing. It's the average.
So I mean, so the question is like, is a factor of 2, is a factor of 2, would it be? But the factor of 2 will be still within 2 sigma here, so.
No, but you can do the inference by trying to infer the star formation rate in the Milky Way.
Yeah, but
then
you can do the inference
by taking an average. The way
here is the average, right? It's not.
And then I'll divide.
So actually, so if you look at the galaxy itself, like here, like between redshift 1, you know, it starts to dip here, but it's actually still like factor of more, maybe 3, the actual object.
Yeah, right? No, I was just wondering what exactly was the gray curve, which was confusing, because if you talk to people that just look at the Milky Way and try to infer the star formation rate of the Milky Way in the past, there's much less variation.
The curve is derived statistically, so Milky Way is supposed to be one object within the distribution.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't see anything that's inconsistent. If you have a factor of 2 change, it still is within this line.
What about for N31? Can we do this more detailed inference of the star formation history for other nearby?
For SPC spirals, you can look at the colors, right? And you infer equal length times for the star formation rates that are consistent with the star formation rate falling. That's completely consistent.
Okay. So star formation history, I'm glad it's very exciting. What I'm excited is that we choose which model which is fiducial when the solid line was still at redshift 3, which didn't evolve to redshift 0, because it was matching, and actually we didn't know which one is better. There is a second model shown by red line, which is pretty much the same, except here we assume that efficiency of star formation is 1%, but we artificially boost the energy injection from supernova. So the early feedback radiation pressure is the same, but supernova inject 5 times more energy, arbitrarily, just to see what sensitivity is. And at early times, it actually was matching the star formation pretty much the same. At late times, it diverged. But at first, we thought, well, these two models look like they could be reasonable. It turns out that one of them then continues to follow. That's something we didn't know when it was running. But now it's at redshift 0.1, and it keeps following, and it turned over more or less at correct place. So now we consider that this solid line is the fiducial model because it matches the star formation history. The dashed line turns out to be behaving differently at late times because this very 5 times larger energy injection leads to pretty violent things happening at redshift between 3 and 1. And it actually leads to very different distribution of stars in the end. And then, so what I'll show you in the following plots, I'll discard most of these lines, and I'll just choose this fiducial solid line, this line that has very similar star formation history, just to show that by itself, matching early star formation history doesn't guarantee that you'll form the same type of galaxy. What happens later also matters. And then for comparison, I'll also show a simulation which has weak feedback. Essentially, it's this one, the solid dashed line. You can see it actually is suppressed at high. It's not quite no feedback model, but at the end, at the late times, it behaves almost like it's no feedback model. So there, all the feedback was the same implementation, so the same momentum injection, so on, so on. It's just that we assume that stars are forming at low efficiency. That model actually essentially converges to the same result as if you neglect all the feedback processes completely. So if you efficiency of star formation is low, then for the same implementation, you just can have a model that just has no effect, no outflows, no feedback effects. First, I'll show you this plot that from the paper by Michael and Aaron Romanowski, this specific angular momentum as a function of stellar mass, the data as the points, and the main progenitor of the Milky Way is shown as lines here. This model is the fiducial model, the blue. This red is weak feedback, weak efficiency, and this is the model where we just boost, it's also weak efficiency, but we boost supernova energy by a factor of 5. And you can see that in the end, this is time evolution, so from early times to late times, and this object is now is plotted to redshift 0.1. This one is at 0.85, I think, and well, actually this one is 0.85, and this is about redshift 1. So they're not plotted at the same redshift, but you can kind of see the trend that as the model with weak feedback has the smallest angular momentum, and it ends up pretty much outside of in ellipticals. The fiducial model is somewhere between ellipticals and the late-type spirals, but it's actually, if you look at distribution of points, it's still close to SA, SAB. So it's not okay. It's still a disk, and I'll show you that it is indeed a disk. And this model looks like it's tracking the envelope of very late-type disks with lots of fluctuations due to mergers at high redshifts, but it's quite close. That's right, yeah. So it doesn't quite match the star formation history. So this is a fiducial model.
Maybe more consistent with Milky Way.
Well, we don't know yet. So just what I show. What is interesting, I think, is that just by changing some parameters, you actually end up with the same halo. You end up with galaxies of a very different different type, different morphology, different angular momentum, and so on. So this is a fiducial model, ratio 0.2. This is how it looks like. So it is a disk. If you plot the surface density profile, you see a bulge component, you see exponential disk. You can do rough fit. If you decompose them, it's a bulge to disk ratio of 0.17, so it's roughly SAB, SBC, so which corresponds to the angular momentum plot. So you could kind of read off the angular momentum, from angular momentum plot, what the rough morphology is, and you can see that it's consistent with the bulge to disk ratio. But the simulation with 5 times more supernova energy also ends up with exponential disk, but much more extended. And if you look at it, this is still redshift 0.85, so it's not a fair comparison to low redshift, but it's much more irregular, much more extended, but it still has exponential disk. It doesn't mean that it's not correct simulation, but it's just that morphologies are quite different. The extent is, the difference in extent of the disk is quite significant. So here is a plot of the tracks of the simulation in this diagram of half-sized stellar mass. This is the 5 times supernova energy with magenta. This is a weak feedback, and this is the fiducial one. So fiducial one actually, and this one track, at early times they track more or less along the observed relation. In the end, this one becomes too large, I would say, compared to most, it lies outside of most of the galaxies, but not too far. I mean, there are some disk galaxies that are not too far from it. Whereas the fiducial simulation, I tried, it's a kind of approaching the Milky Way, which is the star here. I don't know how well you can see. So it's getting closer and closer to Milky Way. But of course, it's not exactly in the Milky Way. And this one is too small, right? It's too compact. This is a standard problem. Feedback is weak. The galaxies become too compact. Right? This is in relation to your question, Nick. So low angular momentum also corresponds to galaxy being too compact. So here, this is size stellar mass relation. Here is the same but size video relation. Here we see that they were higher than relation at redshift 0, but it's not relation corrected for pseudo-evolution. So at high redshifts, they were here. At low redshifts, this fiducial model also pretty much falls onto disk relations, again, close to the Milky Way. This one seems to be somewhat high. At high redshifts, you can see they're high, but there, again, to compare low redshift galaxies to high, we have to correct for pseudo-evolution. If you actually do that, the corrected relation actually starts to match at high redshift. So that's consistent. Now, low redshift doesn't make sense because we don't shouldn't compare. But at high redshift, this corrected relation starts to match observation. So, yeah, yeah. So just low redshift data corrected for the pseudo-evolution effect. This correction, which is physically motivated, with this correction, of course, it's not a proof, but it shows that at high redshifts, these simulations evolve along the same relation of 0.04. So the picture here is consistent with galaxies evolving along the relation of 0.04 times the virial radius, and at layer edge of this relation just shifts due to pseudo-evolution, a smaller fraction. So I'll stop here. Thanks for your attention. Essentially, there's three take-home points that I want to make. First is that the galaxy scaling of galaxy sizes with virial radius is consistent with a simple scenario in which sizes of galaxies, both disks and ellipticals, are set by angular momentum of baryons acquired during the collapse. I found it surprising. You know, I'll leave it up to you to decide whether it's surprising and it's true for both disks and elliptical galaxies. And I showed you, I mean, this is not only our work, it's been now seen in many different simulations. Stellar feedback plays a key role in setting the sizes and angular momenta correctly. What happens to those two quantities that finally are very, very closely related to morphology of the galaxy that is formed is sensitive to the feedback. And it's pretty clear now that simulations with efficient feedback are capable of producing both the sizes and angular momenta of galaxies and approximately correct morphology for objects that are forming, at least producing the disk. We don't know what correct morphology for this particular halo is, but for reasonable combination of parameters, we can form a disk with reasonable mass bulk to disk ratio. Thank you.